Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, June 24th, 2010. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week it's our club spotlight, recorded live at the National Homebrewers Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We spend a few minutes to get to know the Prairie Homebrewing Companions from Fargo, North Dakota. If you're new to homebrewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and you can find our show page at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. You can also find associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on the iTunes Store as well. I'm going to break my usual rule on time limits with this show and with others recorded at the NHC. You're going to have to lengthen your jogging session or your commute because some of these go over an hour, unfortunately. Well, fortunately, because it's good stuff. So you just have to, you just have more goodness, more Basic Brewing Radio goodness to listen to. Steve Wilkes and I had a great time in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you can see evidence of that on our show's Facebook page with all the photos that we took and also in the episode of Basic Brewing video that I've posted this week. Lots of great stuff to come from the National Homebrewers Conference. And I especially want to thank Steve for all the hard work. We were gone from home longer than usual because we drove up there and back. And I appreciate Steve and Steve's family for bearing with us during that time, but we had fun and we got a lot of great information to share with you too. So, well, let's get to it. I complained about the show being too long, and now I'll make it longer. So, let's get right on to it, shall we? We take you now to the Sheraton Bloomington Hotel. Well, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio. I'm James Spencer.
I'm Steve Wilkes,
and this week we are recording in front of real live people at the National Homebrewers Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In this episode, we'll get to know one of the homebrewing clubs from this region of the country, the Prairie Homebrewing Companions of Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Steve and I are extremely excited to be here this week. And we were also excited because we drove up from Northwest Arkansas. And I was so happy not to have to go through airport security that I went out and I bought the biggest jug of shampoo that I could find to put in my carry-on luggage.
So I just put some explosives in my underwear.
The security policy is going to change on Subaru and, on the way home.
Okay.
Well, first off,
it wasn't very comfortable anyway.
First off, I want to thank everybody for coming. The rest of you are probably at the wedding upstairs. I also want to thank the American Homebrewers Association for inviting us to participate. And I want to thank Tony Huseby. Where's Tony? Tony's right here up front, president of the PHC, and all the club members that we'll talk to today for helping us bring this together. And this is, as I said earlier, really an experiment. Because we've never done this before. Usually when we do this podcast, we're in a little padded closet, essentially.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in padded closets.
We got the weekend pass for Steve, though, to come out.
Yeah, well.
And but you're still surrounded by crazy people. So,
That's true.
So we're not used to being watched, so I hope this works out. In case it doesn't work out, we are passing out beers. So so we actually, are we pouring a beer right now as we speak?
Mead.
A mead, okay. Ooh. All right. This is Susan's mead. And we want to start by introducing Susan Rood. And if you can use your microphone there, Susan. Susan has been on the governing committee for what, a decade?
10 years, yeah.
Is that right?
Yes.
And I'm now
off.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, you deserve a rest, I think, after 10 years. You are also a grandmaster BJCP judge.
Yes.
And pretty impressive. And I understand that you're quite the avid brewer and mead maker.
I enjoy making a few. Enjoy drinking a few.
And we're going to talk to you about the mead that we're tasting here in a couple of minutes. But the reason that I asked you on is that you are, in addition to being a member of the PHC, you're also part of bringing this together.
I did serve on the local committee, organizing all of the speakers. So,
what goes into that? I mean, when they asked you to do it, what kind of help did you get, and what kind of ideas did you have for it?
Well, we basically got together with all the three organizers of the committee organizers, and then we just threw out ideas of what type of speakers did we want, what did we want to do with the speakers, and then I sent out an email to TikTok and said, okay, please, anybody that wants to talk, come talk. send me your information. Actually, it was just way easier to get speakers than I thought it would be. People were just excited. I'm honored to come speak. And so it made my life a little easier. It's been a great experience.
And you're the one that they put you in contact with me, and you've been very helpful in facilitating this whole thing. So I appreciate your help. But how many clubs are involved in putting this on?
The main club is the St. Paul Homebrewers, and then I believe there's three other clubs, the Minneapolis Homebrewers Association, the Northern Ale Stars from Duluth, and the Prairie Homebrewing Companions from Fargo. That was all in getting the commemorative meads and beers. We all made 200 to 250 beers and 200 to 250 meads each club did. So that was kind of fun. That was interesting.
Yeah, this is our fifth homebrewing conference, and I think this is the most meads and beers that we've seen, and ciders.
Absolutely, by far. Yeah, I heard the one club had something like 600 kegs that they brought up here.
Well, it's bringing to the...
But can you imagine hauling 600 kegs of beer?
No.
Go Iowa.
Go Iowa.
How long has this been in the works, do you know? I mean, this doesn't just happen overnight.
From the governing committee, it was well over a year ago that St. Paul started putting in a bid for this conference, probably almost 2 years ago, and it was right before last year's conference we knew that it was going to happen here. So it is a little time-consuming. If you're interested in doing a conference, you need to go onto the AHA website or contact Gary Glass from the AHA, and they have a booklet that tells you kind of things you need to go through to what a conference is needed in your area. Mostly, you need a lot of people that are really interested in working very hard to put it together. But it is very exciting to have it in your area and to be part of it. The work has really been worth it.
This is the last session of the conference, and it's been a wonderful conference. Lots of things go on. I mean, not only a lot of things go on behind the scenes that we don't see. If you are not involved in the judging, you may not know that the judging, the final judging for the National Homebrewers Conference happens here
the
as well. The competition. Give us an idea of what goes on behind the scenes to make all this work. What are all these people doing?
Well, any of the people that are around the conference in their yellow shirts are helpers, and anything that anybody needs, they're running to get. They're schlepping the beers back and forth from the coolers. Huge task, organizing everything there. The hotel staff they've been phenomenal getting everything set up and tore down, different for each room. Think of what else. A lot of things fun, but it's just a lot of little things. But a lot of this all happened beforehand. I mean, you had to plan all the beers. You had to plan the every club that wanted to come for club night. That had to be planned ahead of time. All of the brewers that you bring in for Pro Brewers Night is all set up ahead of time. Once the conference happens, it's the local volunteers that move the beer around and all that that have the most work.
So if you're thinking about having or trying to have a national homebrewers conference in your area, what attracts the AHA to the area? I mean, what is it about Minneapolis-St. Paul?
Well, there's a fairly good beer scene here. There's a really good core group of people and clubs that work together well. And that's a large amount of it. Yeah, you know, you need some kind of a beer scene around. You need, and you also need to have a conference hotel that's large enough now. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's becoming a key thing. We need to be able to hold, you know, 1,300, 1,400, 1,500 people.
Yeah, and this is a record year, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's over 1,300 people at this conference.
A lot of folks. This is definitely the loudest pro night and club night. that not only inside, but Steve and I have one of those cabana things. And
somebody let out a war whoop last night about 2:45 in the morning that curled the paint in my room. I don't know what was going on there.
Well, so you have to have the facilities, you have to have the people to run it, and you have to have an area to keep the homebrewers entertained outside the conference.
Yeah, a lot of people will come to the conference, but they'll come several days early and tour the area and do some family stuff. And so.
Now, Steve was talking about this would be a great concept to take kind of regionally or locally even with
I was just curious and thinking about all of the things that you have to do, wouldn't it be cool to have a little one-day or two-day conference in Fayetteville, Arkansas, or Santa Fe, New Mexico, or something like that? We were joking about Fayetteville. We thought there's no, you know, we've got the hotel rooms, but we don't have the beer scene, so it's like, well, you could tour like our house, you know,
my basement.
That's right. You know, one brew pub and a liquor store, and that's about it. So,
That actually sounds like a neat concept. But I'm fairly certain that if you mention that to the AHA staff, they'd screaming.
One of these years, probably, pretty good for them.
But something like that would still have to start being planned several years ahead.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, anybody have any questions about how this thing is organized or how this thing is put together? I mean, you know, a lot of work goes on behind the scenes of this. And next year there are unconfirmed rumors of where it's going to be. So
we'll neither confirm nor deny. No.
But that's always fun as well, finding out where it's going to be next year. And I can tell from experience, if you're planning to come to one of these things, reserve your hotel rooms early. Because if you procrastinate, there's a risk that you can have some issues with getting reservations. So let's talk about this mead.
Yeah.
What are we drinking?
Yeah.
We are drinking a piment made with orange blossom honey and concentrated Oregon puree. Not a piment, I'm sorry, a blackberry mead.
Mm.
It's concentrated blackberry Oregon puree.
That's really good.
It's a sweet mead, probably original gravity was about 1.135. Final gravity was around 25.
How old was this?
This was brewed in March, I think. Tony said, "Can you bring a mead?" And I said, "Maybe." So I threw it together in March.
It's really tasty. The blackberry comes through so beautifully on it. It's how long do most meads go before you're ready to serve them? Just depend on the style.
I used the Ken Schramm, Kurt Stuck, Chris England, now Staggered Nutrient. And they're ready in eight to 12 weeks. The fruit ones.
Sure.
I think traditional takes a little longer still. Mm-hmm. Probably 5 months, 5-6 months on a traditional.
Still, it's way better. I mean, when we started talking about meads, you know, years ago, it's like, it'll be 8 years before we can drink this.
Of course, we were making rocket fuel in the beginning.
Yeah.
So
I'm burning one batch in my car right now.
So talk about that staggered nutrient. How do you implement that?
Set me on the there. let's see. It's the Fermade. I use Fermade K and diammonium phosphate. I can't remember the exact amounts, but whatever you need for the whole batch, you split that in about four different groups. I add the first right when you mix the whole thing up. Let it go 1 to 2 days. Add another bunch, another couple days. Add next, and a couple more days. Add the next, and then you also want to stir and let all the CO2 out of your mead as you go. So, because the carbon dioxide will actually inhibit fermentation.
Does that help rouse the yeast up maybe as well?
Yeah, it rouses the yeast up, but also just getting all that CO2 out of there lets the yeast work.
How vigorous does the stirring have to be? Can you just like a paddle or do you?
I'd go in and start slow because it will come. The second you start and you'll go in about 3 or 4, and all of a sudden it might just be a volcano.
Wow. I made a Mentos mead once with some Pepsi. It wasn't good.
Well, it's very delicious.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions on the mead? You guys are a quiet group. Is it because it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you're...
They're all just waiting for the banquet. <It's>
like... They've been working hard up there at the hospitality suite all day.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Susan, very much.
Thank you.
Well, now we're going to move on to talk to Ray Taylor and Carl Gunderson about the club and the Award of Brewing program that they have going on.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the club.
Yeah, welcome.
One of the reasons I'm up here is I'm old.
Let's hear it for being old. All right.
I'm one of the... four founding spargers of the club. Our club is going to be celebrating its 20th birthday this September. And I was one of the first four founding members, and I'm now the only member left in the club of those first four founding members. One of the guys now lives in Washington, D.C. Another guy bailed out of Fargo and went to Idaho. And we have another guy that lives in the area but is not involved with the club anymore. I'm here because I'm the only one who knows. I'm the club historian today, anyway. One interesting tidbit about the club is it was actually founded about 4 miles from here at the old Sherlock's Home Brew Pub. The four of us got together and drove down for some pints. And I don't know if it was during the trip or while we were here, we got this wacky idea of forming a club. So we had elections in the pub. I was elected the first president. And we turned around and headed back to Fargo, and we had a club formed. And that's the way it started.
You know, oddly enough, that's how our country started. It also founded in a tavern.
It probably did. It started in a pub. So why start a club?
We developed an interest in good tasting beer. I mean, I could go back even further. I could go back to 1975. I lived in New York, and I discovered beer of taste in Ballantine Ale. It was a great beer, and it was a great beer because it tasted different than any other beer that was out there. And the reason it tasted different, it was sold in green bottles, and it was extremely skunky. And we loved that flavor because it was so different from other beers. And then I moved to North Dakota from New York and went a while with there wasn't much beer there. Beer culture was pretty slim. So at one point, my wife and I took a trip out west, and we discovered lots of good microbrews out in Washington, Oregon area. And I got a taste for it. My wife gave me a homebrewing kit about a year later. I started brewing beer, giving beer to my friends. And I got sick of giving beer away, so I tried to talk them into becoming brewers. And that's how basically the core started. Our first four members I worked with. So it was just a bunch of buddies getting together. And then we started looking for other people that had the same interests, and we found that there were some people in Fargo that had the same interest. And we expanded from there. So we're basically in search of flavorful beer that we couldn't get locally. That was the reason to start the club.
And what's the club up to now?
I think we're constantly in the 60 to 70 member range, I guess.
I think we're closer to 75.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're up to 70 to 80.
Yeah.
Been taking a lot of members.
Yeah.
It's growing even as we speak.
Yeah. And and to clarify,
we'll be up there.
And to clarify, too, we're from Fargo, North Dakota, and Moorhead, Minnesota. We're twin cities. So we have members in Fargo and in Moorhead.
So you've got quadruplets almost.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Two twins. So one thing that I want to talk to you guys about is your award of brewing program.
Yeah.
That was extremely interesting.
Okay, I'll get it started, but Carl Gunderson is now the administrator of the program. It was a concept started, actually brought up by one of our former presidents, Tim Schultz, as a way of getting more beer to the meetings and for people to experiment in brewing different beer styles. And the original concept was, because I was old then, I'm still old, I knew a lot about beer styles, and I was basically the pioneer. So the idea was members would bring their beers to me at a meeting, and I would sit down and evaluate whether they made the beer to style and whether it had any problems. Well, I soon discovered that I couldn't possibly taste all these beers at every meeting. It would be too difficult. So now we've broken it up into brewing teams of judges to help get through these beers, because it slows down the process of running a meeting if you have to deal with all the beers. In other words, the program became too successful for us to keep up with. And now Carl administrates the whole program, so he might be able to give you a good rundown on how it all works.
So Carl,
yep,
grab a mic.
Someone?
He's got one over there. Is this mine?
I think it's on.
we're also passing around a beer as well. So raise your hand if you don't get a beer. So Carl, tell us about this program. How's it structured, and how does it work?
Well, it's structured such that there are five levels to the program: recognized, accomplished, master, second degree, and grandmaster. You brew a certain number of beers of a variety of styles to attain each level. So for recognized, you have to brew six beers from six different categories, at least one lager and one ale, so we don't want anybody stuck in lagers or ales. We want brew a variety. Accomplished, same kind of thing, six more beers, one ale, one lager, 12 beers, everything, it's cumulative. Master, you have to brew something from every category.
Wow.
So with the current categories, 28 beers total.
Now, does that include the beers that they've already brewed?
That's right. So since you already have brewed 12, you only need to brew 16 more.
Only 16.
Only 16 more. Master second degree, 26 more beers. And then for grandmaster, every subcategory, all 89 or something like that.
Wow. And so these beers, you don't just have to brew the beers.
Right. You bring them in for evaluation. We have probably at least two, if not three people judge each beer. They must be brewed to the style that they were submitted to without any major defects. We give them a score. If they score 25 or better, they pass. If it's below, they don't pass. And then they get logged and credited. And as they fulfill each level, they get a certificate. And
So when you're talking about scores, are these BJCP scores?
Yep, we use the BJCP guidelines and the scoring system, a 50-point system. Yep.
So how many people participate in the program?
Well, I can tell you exactly how many people. I've written a little software here, and I have 62 brewers in my brewer database, and I have 1,074 beers in my entry database.
Wow. So you must do something like this for a living.
I do. Right.
So what do the brewers get out of this? I mean, Ray, you may want to chime in on this as well. Why would you want to participate in this program?
Well, the main reason is the club actually gets benefit because the brewers, when they bring each sample in, have to bring a minimum of 2 liters. So as a brewer was bringing in 4 beers for evaluation, I would have to bring at least 4 2-liter bottles so we can pass them around at the club after they've been evaluated in the program. The brewers themselves, when they reach each of these levels, will be receive an award. Mm-hmm. The first 2 levels, they receive nice certificates documenting their achievements. And when they've reached the level of master, the club gives them a engraved mug commemorating their achievements with their name and the date that they finished reached the master level. The 2 higher levels where you basically are doing all the subcategories, you receive a certificate and that's it. So the whole idea of the program was directed toward becoming a master. You get the mug at that point. The other 2 additional higher levels are actually added on. The program initially was just to get to this master level. But club members wanted to keep making beer. Once we got them started making beer, they wanted to continue to make beer. So we created these additional 2 levels, and they basically just receive a certificate. But in addition to that, the club also gets a benefit because in addition to receiving the certificate, in order to receive that certificate, they have to brew the certain number of beers, but they also have to do a club service component where they have to do something different for the club that they wouldn't normally do. Huh. And so in order to achieve that level and receive the certificate, they have to do both. They brew the beers and do a service component.
Wow. So I would imagine that you get brewers brewing out of their comfort zone. I mean, if somebody likes to just brew pale ales and porters, if they've got to brew all of the styles or all of the categories, they're going to learn something new.
Yes, they are. And that's another major reason for the program's existence. And I think one of the reasons for its success is that it really does encourage people to stretch themselves a little bit and gets a variety of different beers to the meeting for other people to try. And it's self-perpetuating in that way because you get feedback, you learn how to brew better, you bring better beers to the meeting, you get kudos from your peers, and it's just really, really a very positive program.
So there's also a People's Choice beer, isn't there? Tell us about that.
Brewers can bring in beers for the award of brewing. They can also bring in beers that they just want to share and not enter in the award of brewing. And they're just put on the table during a meeting, and anybody in the any members or guests just sample the beers all evening, and then at the end of the night they basically just select the beer they like the best. Hmm. No BJCP style guidelines. If it's a beer, if it's your favorite beer, you vote for it.
Wow.
And the winner of every monthly club meeting receives some gift certificate for their efforts.
Well, that sounds like fun. It sounds like that you're challenging them, and at the same time you're rewarding them and getting them into the giving them some incentive to get into the brew house and and get into the kitchen.
Yeah, and the program has really worked because we've had no complaints. Everybody is it's a positive experience for everybody, so it's been great.
So Carl, how do you keep track of all this stuff?
Well, I've got an Access database that I log everything into. But then actually putting things into categories takes a little bit more work, so I've written some additional software that pulls the data out of Access and actually builds. Let me back up just a little bit. It was originally all done first time through when it was a simpler program, all on a Word document. Here's Ray's original Word document. And then he got a little fancier, and he's a scientist, by the way. Huh? That's Dr. Taylor. And so he's really good with spreadsheets. So he built some spreadsheets to handle this. So we were keeping track of things like this in a spreadsheet. And that we had actually a spreadsheet for overall, and then each brewer had their own individual spreadsheet. And here's Susan's, for instance. And so, you know, it's a matter of entering.
Is this privileged information that we're looking at here?
Not terribly, no. you know, it did require entering the data twice. And sometimes, you know, since it's a manual process, getting things into the right categories and so on was, you know, people make mistakes, typing errors, whatever. You write something down, and then you look at it, and that looked like a 2 the first time, and the second time you look at it, it looks like a 5.
I have no idea what you're talking about there.
Yeah, right. at least I make those mistakes. So I wanted something where I could just enter it once and have the software calculate all of these different categories. And so that's what I have here. So what I do is I enter all the – I have this sheet right here that unfortunately the radio audience can't see, but – This page right here where I enter a beer in, just enter the date, the brewer, the style they intended to brew, who was judging, the score they received, and then whether there were any comments. And notice I have a duplicate button down here. More than one brewer can get credit for one beer if the two of them worked on it as a team. So I can duplicate it and then just change the brewer's name. And so once that's all done, then I can run a little program that I wrote. I'll just run it real quick.
I learned how to write a program in high school, and it wrote my name across the screen about 1,000 times.
Okay.
That's my level of programming.
So right here you see it's going through each brewer, and what it's doing is actually building a spreadsheet in the background. So you can see I've got actually 2 copies of Excel running here, one that you can see right there and one you can't. So it's building a spreadsheet in the background. And when it finishes, it will take and print those spreadsheets to a single PDF, and then I can upload that PDF to our Yahoo group, and everybody can see their updated record month to month. And then I also produce a summary that shows in detail all their information. So here is, as soon as this finishes, so there's the last brewer, and then it will create the, it's probably got a little thing going here. I can just show you the finished product. Don't have to wait for it.
Murphy's Law is fully in first here.
You bet.
In first.
There goes.
Thank you, Susan.
Now it's making
the
PDF.
Slur.
There it goes.
So if somebody were interested in getting into the Award of Brewing program and needed some software to take care of it, could they contact you?
Sure, absolutely. So there's the finished PDF. And so it shows in columns here how many beers you've got credit for in each one of the 5 categories, the date of that brew, and then at the bottom it shows the awards you received and so on, and how many beers you need yet to brew to get to the next level, so on.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
So any questions on the Award of Brewing program, you guys?
How can I sign up?
How can you?
Move to Fargo.
To Fargo.
You have to start shipping 2-liter bottles to us.
Yeah. Well, you have to come to meetings, so you have to be a member. Come to meetings, so you have to ship yourself.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Well, it's an excuse.
Well, one other note on this program. It's started in 1999, and the first evening that we were accepting beers, we got one entry. And this is going to be easy. I mean, one beer a month, it would be easy to judge. And then I think we've been averaging now up to 25 or 30 prior to each meeting.
Wow.
I administrated the program for 10 years, and it was a long time. And Carl took over for me. Now he is running it, and I really appreciate the work he's done to actually improve what we did in the past. And during the time that I was running it, I was contacted by probably a half a dozen different homebrew clubs from around the country, just getting them asking about the program and trying to get some information about it. And I had an article published in Zymergy in 2006, I believe, summarizing the program. So there is some information out there on how we did it and the breakdown of the categories of your levels of achievement.
Well, excellent.
Who judges the beers?
BJCP judges in the club.
So it's real life. Generated.
Yes, and we don't use the complete BJC CP judging sheet. We try to get these judged in under 5 minutes per beer. So we will give them a numerical score based on the breakdown of the BJCP sheet, and then we'll give them a written evaluation as to why the beer may or may not pass. So it's more of a we have to process these quickly, but they are based on the style guidelines.
So how many beers don't pass? I mean,
probably under 10%, maybe. You
know, easily under 10%. Yeah. Yeah, one or two a meeting typically.
Well, that's great.
But I'm curious what the most common flaw is that you run across. I mean, is it an infection flaw, or is it just you just didn't hit the mark? It's a bitter, but it's full of
brown. Those are the two flaws. It's either fermentation defects, I think, are the main one. And very rarely do they they miss the style. I mean, that's not...
Not too often.
And the advantage you have there is if you tell them they miss the style and this... would have been better entered as a English brown and not a Vienna. They can bring it back next month and enter it as an English brown if they still have any left.
There you go.
How many masters do you have right now?
I don't know if I have that exact number here, but I could probably get it with a little bit of time.
Come on, Carl.
I'd estimate that we have maybe six or seven. Uh-huh. We also have two... Grandmasters who have completed all subcategories, like 90.
Holy smokes! How long does that take?
Several years. Neither of those individuals are members of the club anymore. So currently, one passed away, and we actually have an award each year at our holiday party, honoring him because he was one of the first grandmasters.
What's his name?
Dennis Reimer. Yeah.
What's exciting? Questions? Well, thanks, guys. I'm going to carry one of these around all the time.
Yeah.
I've got a little applause sign for those at home that will beg for applause. We got one question. Oh yeah, we get well. Thanks, Norm. We're on next.
It's a great segue.
Thanks for keeping us on track. The second beer was this year. Was this yours, Dave?
Yeah, this was. This one's my fault.
This is Dave Batchelor, ladies and gentlemen.
So, volunteers, do we have some more of that left? Some more bottles open. Sensory perceptions being what they are, knowing what it is now may change your perception of the beer, so we'll get some more in rotation. What you've got making its way around for the second time is a Imperial Belgian Pale Ale weighing in at a paltry 9.8% alcohol by volume that went into a secondary re-fermentation on Chardonnay-marinated medium-toast Hungarian oak cubes, whole seed coriander, and Seville orange peel. Yeah, it's kind of mundane. I'm pretty involved with homebrewing and really have pushed myself to get at the oaked and spiced and the kind of beers that are difficult to get from professional breweries or all limited run things and kind of wine barrel aged beers are something that I'm passionate about. And so this was a beer that was devised as kind of one of the things that where I completely ignore the BJCP guidelines and just come up with something that I think is a pretty unique combination of flavors and has got some meaningful depth.
We've got a Reinheitsgebot is a four-letter word shirt for you.
I'm fairly certain there's a new style. It's called Dave.
So say again what it's on.
So it's the base is an Imperial Belgian Pale Ale, which is really just a pretty base Pils malt base with a little Cara Munich, Cara Vienna, and Vienna. And then there's three different sugars in there, dextrose, light candy sugar, and cane sugar. It's fermented on Belgian Ardennes and then goes into... So I take the Hungarian toast oak, and I put that with wine in the fridge for a couple of months. leave it. And then I pull that out when it's, you know, it's kind of penetrated into the interior of the cubes, and I'll steam it for about 5 minutes with the orange peel. And then that, some of the broth, about half the broth, and the oak and the orange goes into secondary.
So how do you steam it?
Just overheat in a, kind of a small stainless boil pot. It's pretty straightforward, just like you'd kind of steam vegetables, but the aromatics that come are much much different and pretty aggressive.
It's nice that the oak doesn't come through too strong. I get kind of tired of things that are just like, oh my God, that's oak. That's really oaky. But this is so nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, it's I don't want to make a table leg out of this. This is it's nice and balanced. So how did you work your way up to this? What was the evolution of this beer?
This was the fourth recipe I ever made up. There wasn't much of an evolution to it. I had a Belgian pale ale, and I thought, boy, that's good. I wish it had about another 4% alcohol by volume, And then if I threw that on some wood and some wine, some coriander,
that's more intelligent design than evolution, I think. We have a question way over there.
Way over here. Yeah, is the Ardennes yeast the
La? Actually, I believe it's the Deconic yeast.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any more questions? This is delicious. How old is this?
This beer peaks at about a year. This sample is 2 months old.
Wow. When you say it peaks, what does it do?
The wood, you kind of get the eugenol out of the wood a little bit more, so you get more soft wood aromatics, like a little bit of coconut there. Right now, the wine is kind of forward in the vanillin, and the softer oak character comes out over time.
So how do you age on the wood? I assume you rack to a secondary?
Yep, rack to a secondary in glass with the wood in there. And then this stays on the wood for somewhere in the 3 or 4 week range. I'll just grab it with some with a thief every couple days after it hits 3 weeks. And when I think it's about ready to go, then it goes into the bottles and cork it up.
So with such a big beer, how do you handle fermentation management? How do you make sure that you get a healthy fermentation? What are your tricks?
It's down to brass tacks basics on huge pitch rates, right? So I get a stir plate going, and I get a real, meaningful 2-liter starter. I'll kind of decant off some of the stuff on top, kick up that cake pretty nicely and pitch that. I do add a little yeast nutrient to this, ferment it just under 70 degrees, and then, you basically get a blow off and look out, because it's a variant of this has clogged a blow off and decorated a ceiling before.
How much did that cost in paint?
The paint wasn't so bad. My wife, when she came up and said a beer exploded, and I said, I thought maybe a bottle or something, and she said, no, it was that thing in the kitchen. And then I was really concerned. I thought she meant the carboy exploded, and I was just horror-struck that I lost the beer, because the beer was kind of important. When I found out it was the ceiling and she saw my reaction, oh, that's okay. that buried me a little bit farther in the doghouse.
So it cost in the relationship factor, not in the pocketbook factor.
It's like any good homebrewer relationship. She's remarkably tolerant of the gingerbread smell of my house, and I'm careful not to abuse that.
What wood did you use?
What wood?
What wood? It was medium toast Hungarian oak cubes. I had a variant of this at club night that didn't last very long last night. That was French and Pinot Grigio. Across the different woods, I really like Hungarian oak in Belgian styles. I think that you kind of get some harsher, more kind of aggressive wood aromatics out of the French, and it's almost can be kind of tannic in its mouthfeel. And I like to stick with Hungarian because it's a little softer. You get some kind of chocolatey notes out of it. You have very nice vanillin, and then if you give it time, if you can leave your hands off the beer long enough, you do get some of that really nice soft wood character too.
Now, do you toast those yourself?
No. These are Northern Brewer classics. Just bought it right from Northern Brewer. I have tried toasting my own wood, and I found the results were kind of unpredictable. And I don't think that I've mastered that science enough. But but maybe again, we'll see.
And that's a lot of malt to be throwing at an experimental process. Hence the small batches, by the way.
And the you know, one thing that was difficult to get a hold of remaking this beer and ultimately settling into a recipe that was good was learning to use enough sugar. There is an enormous amount of sugar. It's almost 20% of the fermentables.
Really?
So it's, you know, to get the real light body, but without using so much that you, you know, it tastes real alcoholic. You know, it's kind of, the first thing is, you know, getting comfortable using sugar to boost your gravity. And the second thing is learning to use enough. That was challenging, but ultimately, you know, settled into about that 17 to 20% range for this beer.
Very nice. Any other questions? One question.
I'm two levels through, so I'm that would be recognized, right, Carl?
Achieved.
Accomplished?
Yeah.
Accomplished. See, I'm progressing quickly, but
Dave is going to have a hard time becoming a master because he keeps making Belgian style beers, and he's going to have to expand.
Yeah, we'll see when that mead finally settles out. I've got an Imperial Coffee Brown Ale Breguet, and that'll check another box for me. I do a lot of Category 23. And then the 16E, yeah, I'm good at that too.
We judged a Category 16 at in Oklahoma recently.
That's right.
That's an interesting category to judge. Well, thank you very much.
I think we've got a question
out
here.
One more question.
Thank you.
Well, kudos from Norm.
Well, no, let's...
I didn't even have to do this. Thanks, Dave. Now up next is Tom Roan. Roan?
Yes. Yes.
Roan?
Roan.
Roan, Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about, I understand, sources tell me that it gets chilly up here.
Just a little. Depends on your definition of cold.
So, yeah, we were talking. Steve and I were at a restaurant the other night, and we're talking to somebody who's from around here, and they said it only gets to 20 below a couple weeks out of the year.
Yeah.
So,
a couple weeks, yeah, maybe a little bit more. 30 below for only just a few days.
So, what we're going to talk to you about is brewing with and against the Midwest climate, and we should be serving the third beer as we're. They're just waiting for the signal. But brewing with and against the Midwest climate, I mean, what when it gets that cold, what strategies do you have to enlist?
For myself and I guess a lot of homebrewers that as you're getting up and running, you don't have unlimited sources of income or, you know, money to throw into the homebrewing stuff. And so, you know, when it gets cold and you're brewing out in the garage and you're running a hose, that means from the wall on the house to the garage, that means you have to either have that hose wide open or you need to get it inside real quick. and that's especially in the cold is what we always think of, and that becomes a big issue. Fermentation, on the other hand, is another one. Your house, when it's that cold out and you don't want, you know, you've got your heat level set in your main living quarters to a certain temperature, you might mainly ferment in the basement, say. Well, that could be 50 degrees, 60 degrees. That might be a little cold to get the real big phenolics out of a Belgian beer.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a great Kolsch, though.
Do you find yourself brewing styles with the season? Not working against the weather, but working with it?
Yeah. And that is a big part of that is brewing to it. Like I said, December is a great time to do a Kolsch. January is a horrible time to do anything. just because of that freezing thing. And I've frozen... brewers before.
Brewers themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Forget the beer.
Yeah, we had some friends of ours who travel around for work, and they happened to be stationed in Fargo for a while, and they were just over the winter. and we hadn't brewed for a while. And I really wanted to get our friend's husband into brewing, so I thought we should do a beer. And it turned out to be one of those nice afternoons running into a late evening of brewing that went 20 below and froze the garden hose. But luckily the plate chiller worked really fine without any water going through it at that point in time. There was rags frozen to the concrete for months. And
a carboy.
And a carboy. But it really made a fantastic beer.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, we were talking to a couple of guys last night, and they were saying they were brewing on the patio when it was 10 below one time, and they were making ice beers just by swirling their glasses.
Oh, yeah.
It was freezing and concentrating as they were standing on the patio. So, so how are summers? How's it getting the summertime around here?
And that's one thing that we do have. We get to experience all four seasons to the fullest. in the summers we have 90-100 degree temperatures, and you're exactly in the opposite. That basement that you were doing a nice kolsch in at 50 degrees is now at 70 degrees, and so your focus, your attention starts to focus more towards those warmer ales. Hefeweizens, you know, of course are great for summer beers, and you slip in a nice big Belgian in there to really get a little bit of the spicy phenolics out. But yeah, it gets to be a big shift. Your garage is open, the neighbors are watching. the heat gets a little warm. You're wearing shorts, burning your leg hair off.
That sounds like home. Back in Arkansas.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you got either the best or the worst of both worlds, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. I like to look at it from the positive side. And, helps us pass some of those water brewing styles. Gets through a number of different ones. And it always keeps everything interesting.
Well, there you go. Any questions for Tom?
I just want to say, as the Wisconsin brewer, it's quite the challenge.
Pollen in Wisconsin in the spring.
And come August, you're making sure your bugs don't get into your
blood. Yeah, I understand the mosquitoes are challenging around here.
Yeah, mosquitoes in the summertime really get to be a challenge also.
What about the walleye? Do they ever get in?
Only into those special ones.
Only those special beers.
What category is that?
We're going to experimental again. another good point about springtime is you may have seen us in the last couple of years surrounded by water in our area.
Oh, yeah.
We have a certain river that tends to overflow its riverbanks in the spring. And another big deal that we have to deal with is our municipal water all comes from the river. And that water will change considerably throughout the year, and especially in the springtime when the water is really high. It's tough to brew over a couple of weeks when that river's cresting.
So does it change the water chemistry, or?
Yeah, the surface water, because it's based on all of your runoff, especially from the fields, and so your water chemistry will change a little bit. We can get certain amounts of data from the municipal water source, but any given day could be different. They even told, I ended up trying to talk to one person that I knew graduated with from college and who worked out there for a little bit, and he said, yeah, some days we can dump a ton of salt in there, wow. And other days nothing.
I think we've got a question out here.
Yeah, when it's negative 20 out there, how long does it take to bring your boil down to pitching temperature?
Oh, you can open that sucker wide open. you have to just a nice Charon plate exchanger works very efficiently at that. You have to turn your water down a little bit because you're coming through the hose, that chills it really, really well. Too cold. And like I said, with the hose that one time, that was an interesting experiment. One of the first times we used the plate chiller, and we're like, oh, this is working so efficiently. Turn it down, turn it down, turn it down. And all of a sudden, one of my friends, or actually probably Mike, was sitting out there, goes, there's no water coming out. So, and we were still wide open with, you know, with putting flow through that thing and coming out probably 60, 65, 70 degrees.
Well, that sounds like a challenging and fun brewing environment. So thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. We're almost out of time. I want to bring up Vince Rocky. Vince is hiding in the back. We're drinking his beer right now. So, the beer itself gets applause. So, what are we drinking?
This is an American Pale Ale that I've brewed. There's a single hop in here, many hop additions. But from front to back, it's Amarillo hops.
Oh, I was going to guess. I was going to have people guess.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I would have said Amarillo if you hadn't.
Yeah, exactly. the history behind this beer is it kind of got – I was inspired to make something like this in the 2003 Nationals, which I believe was in Chicago. I know it was in Chicago, but I think it was 2003. It was my first experience with Amarillo hops. I think Three Floyds – brewery was there, and they had something called Gumball Head Ale, which was, I think, a summer wheat beer that had Amarillo hops in it. And I was just like, wow, these are absolutely heaven. And I kind of wanted to start making an American Pale Ale. So initially I thought if I could do something where I had something like a Sierra Nevada Pale Ale grist, and I could combine that with Amarillo hops. And that was kind of the working plan to begin with. And so I started making it, sharing it with the club and getting the feedback from the local brewers and entering into several competitions. And using the feedback that I was getting back from those, tweaked it and changed it over about a two-year time span. And at times, I brew it probably every other batch that I brewed. I brew 8 to 12 times a year. And sometimes I was making conscious changes to it. And other times, initially I had a little bit of melanoidin malt in it, and then one day I was going to brew, and I thought I had melanoidin malt, and of course I didn't. So I thought, well, you know, and this is not exactly an American Pale Ale ingredient necessarily, say, but I used Munich malt because I had some of that, and a very small amount. And then when that beer came out, I went, hey, we're going to stay with the Munich malt. So there's some serendipity in this as far as how it turned out. But the biggest thing I think the club helped with was most of the changes came in within the hopping and the hopping rates and when the different additions were. And initially, it just wasn't getting enough in the aroma. Mm-hmm. And that was probably what was kind of keeping it down. And so I tried different techniques to improve the aroma on it. One of them was using a hop back, and that didn't, you know, it worked a little bit better, but it wasn't as great as I thought it should be, and it still wasn't scoring real high and getting dinged for aroma. So it wasn't until I started dry hopping, which is not probably a big shocker to most people here in this room. So, but had to get through that fear. What I think probably most did was just dumping dry leaf hops right into the beer, and oh my God, it's going to infect it, and you know, and it didn't. And then about 2005, this one did pretty well here at the Nationals. And it's kind of been done well over the last few years here within the club. So,
since you're being modest with, kind of done well. So where's Steve? What do you think?
I think it's great. What I really like about this is the watermelon. I mean, that's that Amarillo thing that happens, but it's just got such a nice hot flavor without it just knocking you down the bitter. I get tired of beers that are so bitter, but this has such a great Amarillo citrus watermelon thing happening. It's terrific. Mm-hmm. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, as much of a hop lover, I haven't really gravitated to the super over the top Imperial IPAs. I can appreciate them and judge them, but I like them down more in this at this level of hoppiness and bitterness.
Yeah, and I really like the flavor of hops, but they just get whew, it blows my palate out, and I can't even taste like a barbecued rib after I've had it. You know,
the yin and the yang.
The yin and yang.
Yeah, or the hop thing. So talk about the hopping schedule.
Like I said, it's all Amarillo hops. Again, when I brew, I try to keep things fairly simple for myself to know that. So then, if I make a change, I know what you know. If something was different, hopefully it was based on that change. So there's first wort hopping in this. So as soon as I get a couple inches in the boil kettle, I put in about an ounce and a half or ounce point two. Roughly, the Amarillos, depending on the year that I get them, are sometimes as low as 7% and as high as 9.8. So the amounts vary based on that. The IBUs on this is about 40, 41.
Hmm.
The original gravity on this is about 10.55.
Huh. I would have thought the IBUs would be a little higher.
And
I mean, it's nice. It's nicely bitter, but like Steve said, not overly bitter.
It's that balance thing, James.
I'm unbalanced. What can I say?
So the next hop addition then is at 60 minutes. I do a 90-minute boil. And I got sick of having boilovers, so I like to boil it for a while before I start throwing in the next addition. So I don't mind adding a few more hops at 60 to avoid the boilover at 90 or at 75. And then there's a hop addition at 15 minutes, one at 5. And then it gets 4 ounces, doesn't matter what the IBUs, and then 4 ounces of pellets at knockout.
Wow.
And then it gets dry hopped. And in the boil, it's all pellet hops, if I can, depending on supply. And then I dry hop with Amarillo leaves. And this is an 11-gallon batch, by the way. 4 ounces of leaf hops in the secondary. And that stays anywhere. I find that if by 2 weeks, it's fine. Sometimes, though, I'm lazy and I don't get to it in a couple months.
Hmm.
And I don't notice a big difference between 2 weeks to 2 months as far as it adding any more hop aroma at
really?
That point. So, and at that point, I usually just keg it, and away we go.
Talk about why do you do hop pellets at one edition and whole leaf at another edition? Why would you choose to do that?
You know, I've kind of done it. We have another very good brewer in our club that does the reverse of that. I don't know. I think it might just be a personal preference. One reason I do, if I use the leaf, because I'm using so much, an 11-gallon batch, depending on the alpha acid content of the hops, this can be, you know, 12 and a half ounces of hops, or 8.5 in the boil. So 8.5 ounces of leaf hops takes up a lot of volume of liquid. And so, you know, you don't get as much at the end. And so that's why I prefer to use pellets, just because otherwise my yield gets pretty low.
Do you squeeze the hops at the end?
I don't now. There's been a batch where I've done it. I ruin my basement now, so I'm a little bit insulated from the weather things that you talked about earlier. Although when I was in my garage, I've had, you know, either assigned to myself or a kid to come out every once in a while and walk on the hose to keep it from freezing while we were brewing.
Time to walk the hose.
Yeah. There was one summer brew session where this was why. I used leaf hops in the boil and choked up the outlet trying to get her through the chiller. And my brother-in-law, Todd Fogelstad, who's in the back corner, by the way, was there with me. And we said, "Oh, what are we going to do? We only got a couple gallons in the fermenter, so we ended up basically scooping out the hops and pouring everything through a colander, sanitizing our hands, and squeezing out the wort right
been
in."
There.
And
I been thought, there, done that.
Yeah. And I thought, this is going to be horrible. And I didn't really. We drank it fast to make sure that we didn't find anything horrible down the long run. So it wasn't bad right away, but we made sure it went quickly. So.
Yeah, we Andy Sparks and I were making a really hoppy beer one time, and Andy had, you know, Andy's crazy about the hops and the whole hops, and about like half the brew kettle was full of hops at the end of the racking, and so we got a grain bag and put all the hops in there, and we're squeezing this bag over the sink saying, "We're ruining this beer, but we can't help it." But it was wonderful, so don't be afraid to squeeze the bag.
That's what...
Stop
I
that.
I won't say it.
You behave. any that's the next shirt.
Any questions about the hoppy beer? Question?
No, I've never noticed that.
No. What was the question?
Do the hops get grassy leaving in the dry hop that long?
At least not with this Amarillo. It just seems to be the grapefruit flavor that comes through the whole time. I don't get the grassiness.
There's a little bit of mango in there too, I think.
That's Carmen Miranda. Tropical fruit salad.
I paid exorbitant amounts of money to get Amarillo. I wasn't going to sacrifice. I wanted what I wanted.
Well, here's the man with the giant hook. So we've run past the time, but I appreciate all of you. We know that there's free beer upstairs, and you chose to come down here with us. So I appreciate each and every one of you, and I see a lot of faces that I've shook hands. You know, I haven't shaken hands with your face, but I've shaken hands with. Shaking hands with a hand that's associated with a face, and it's probably about time I get off the microphone.
Yeah, well, you're out of material. But
anyway, we appreciate you guys so much. Thank you so much. Well, what a great show. I can't thank the members of the Prairie Homebrewing Companions enough for helping out, and I want to single out Tony Huseby again. You didn't hear him. But we couldn't have pulled this off without his time and work and energy, and I appreciate that so much. And thanks again to the PHC members and volunteers that you heard and didn't hear who made it all possible. Such a great group, very interesting programs that they've got going on there, and awesome mead and beers as well. I'm going to take most of July off, as I've said before. Friends are coming into town. We've got family vacations. We got weddings. You name it. However, next week I'm going to run the keynote address from Mark Stutrud from Summit Brewing Company. So look forward to that. And we'll kick July off well. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our 2010 Brewer's Logbooks are gone. All gone. But you'll have to wait till next year to get your logbook. It's a calendar in the front. You know, we got to keep current there, don't we? But we do have our Reinheits Gebot is a four-letter word shirts on our shop along with our other shirts. And you can check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find combo deals on our site to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks again to everyone who's continued to click on our Amazon.com associate link. We appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Vermont's Original Bag Balm Protective Ointment, 10 ounce. I guess that was originally for cows. And PJ Sock Monkey Kit. Thanks again. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the links on our site as well. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dodson down in Austin, Texas. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.